In a Christian nation, not far, far enough away.
I'm proud to be partnering with my very good friend, Lee Greenwood. Who doesn't love his song, God Bless the USA, in connection with promoting the God Bless the USA Bible. This Bible is the King James Version and also includes our founding father documents. Yes, the Constitution, which I'm fighting for every single day, very hard, to keep Americans protected. Also, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and the Pledge of Allegiance are all part of this God Bless the USA Bible. And it's just very important and very important to me. I want to have a lot of people have it. You have to have it for your heart, for your soul. Many of you have never read them and don't know the liberties and rights you have as Americans and how you are being threatened to lose those rights. It's happening all the time. It's a very sad thing that's going on in our country, but we're going to get it turned around. Religion and Christianity are the biggest things missing from this country, and I truly believe that we need to bring them back, and we have to bring them back fast. I think it's one of the biggest problems we have. That's why our country is going haywire. We've lost religion in our country. All Americans need a Bible in their home, and I have many. It's my favorite book. It's a lot of people's favorite book. This Bible is a reminder that the biggest thing we have to bring back America and to make America great again is our religion. Religion is so important. It's so missing, but it's going to come back, and it's going to come back strong, just like our country is going to come back strong. In the end, we do not answer to bureaucrats in Washington. We answer to God in heaven. Christians are under siege. We must protect content that is pro-God. We love God, and we have to protect anything that is pro-God. We must defend God in the public square and not allow the media or the left-wing groups to silence, censor, or discriminate against us. We have to bring Christianity back into our lives and back into what will be again a great nation. Our founding fathers did a tremendous thing when they built America on Judeo-Christian values. Now that foundation is under attack, perhaps as never before. What can we do? Stand up, speak out, and pray that God will bless America again. I'm proud to endorse and encourage you to get this Bible. We must make America pray again.
Make America pray again? I will acknowledge the prospect of a Trump presidency is probably making a few people pray. The rest of the video is more commercial for Lee Greenwood's Bible. I had another opening for this episode, but I decided that a political candidate using the Bible as a political prop and his candidacy to promise Christian supremacy is as Christian nationalist as it gets. It seems obvious that Trump isn't trying to reach all Americans. There are many Christians who believe this Bible is on the edge of using God's name in a vain way. And there are many Americans who have religious beliefs which are not based on the Bible. It's pretty clear that Trump's view of America doesn't really include them. I'm not even sure all members of the groups I profile in this episode would be okay with that sales job for Greenwood's Bible. But I suspect most of them would at least understand the sentiment, and I can't think of a more thematic way to kick off part two of Still Searching for Christian America. I'm Warren Throckmorton, and along with Michael Coulter, wrote Getting Jefferson Right, Fact-Checking Claims About Thomas Jefferson. You're listening to the podcast series Telling Jefferson Lies, a story about how history can be hijacked for ideological and political purposes. In previous episodes, we told the story of how David Barton's best-selling book about Thomas Jefferson was removed from publication in 2012 due to historical errors. Today, I present part two of our two-part look at the various approaches to the quest for a Christian America. We are working our way toward a look at the consequences of Christian nationalism and a celebration of the virtues of the separation of church and state. This is episode 10, Still Searching for Christian America, part 2. Surprisingly, nobody came forward this week to explain which Christianity was going to dominate in the new Christian nationalist regime. Probably not many Christian nationalist leaders are listeners, but I was hoping somebody would step up to the task. One benefit of looking at the fragmentation, I would say diversity, but that's a swear word to many of these folks, within the Christian nationalist world is the reality check that it brings. There is no way people with this many differences are going to put together a movement that could rule the nation. There isn't anything they can do together, let alone rule a nation. Many of them are angry at liberals, but their biggest problem is each other. Tears for Fears was right. Everybody wants to rule the world, and these folks are on a mission from God, and in no mood for a coalition. Last week, I described a research-based approach to understanding Christian nationalism and got started examining several ideological variations. Some people who want Christians to rule the land view Christianity as a part of a nostalgia for God and country. Some are worried about losing white majority, and as Matt Walsh and the League of the South warn, the extinction of the mythical white race. Catholics and Orthodox Christians have their own perspective on how government should direct morality and impede individual natural rights. I should also add that there are Christian-adjacent religious groups, such as Latter-day Saints and the Unification Church, which have strong nationalistic features. Mormon Glenn Beck is the most prominent example of someone who works with David Barton and the right-wing Christian nationalists. Beyond those observations in this episode, I want to examine the perspectives of the National Prayer Breakfast Movement, the right-wing Christian nationalists, Reconstructionists, and non-denominational apostolic charismatics.
All that thrills my soul is Jesus. He is more than life to me.
I have only kept the ones that are absolutely said by Jesus. I won't quote Paul, Peter, James, John, I'm not following them. A believer, in what sense we're talking about, is a follower of Jesus Christ. So let's follow him. Let's not follow Nehemiah, Esther, and John, and all. I get kind of concerned about Protestants' view of Catholics and their great concern about Mariolatry. And kind of leaving Jesus in the background. Often the very people that complain about them are guilty of Paulolatry. They wonder, how come we're so big on Paul? I think we ought to be big on both, but I think we ought to be bigger on Jesus Christ. Because without Jesus Christ, Mary and Paul are nothing. And neither are we. Without him, we are absolutely nothing.
That was Doug Coe, who, like David Barton, was once considered by Time magazine as one of America's most influential evangelicals. Until his death in 2017, Coe was the spiritual leader of the Fellowship Foundation, the organization which hosts the National Prayer Breakfast at the Washington Hilton on the first Thursday in February. Coe dramatically extended the vision of Fellowship founder Abraham Verrede. Before the Seven Mountains and Lance Wallnout's Portals of Glory, Before Rush Dooney's Institutes of Biblical Law, there was Abraham Verrede and the Fellowship Foundation, also known as the Family. Verrede was a Norwegian convert who came to believe that his message should go to the up and out instead of the down and out. In other words, he wanted to reach strong men who were leaders in power in various aspects of society, especially political leaders. His goal was to get politicians praying together so that the United States might be a, quote, God-directed and God-controlled nation, end quote. Verrede started in Seattle getting businessmen to pray together and as a friend of business interest to work against unions. As he moved into national circles, he networked at the highest levels of the federal government using prayer to gain political influence. Eventually, his movement led to the formation of the National Prayer Breakfast. Verrede's granddaughter, Marlene Zerbe, told Asmund Brovig a brief summary of how the prayer breakfast came about.
And it was in New York City where he met a woman by the name of Mrs. Amar Johnson, who had a vision for the leadership. And she had a lovely home in Washington, D.C., and asked Abram to come and visit her in D.C. And so Abram went and visited in D.C. and met Marion down there, and she opened up her home to have a group of the leadership come, the social people of Washington, and Abram shared about his vision of a leadership led by God. And it was there that the concept of working with the House and the Senate prayer breakfast started. And eventually the home, which was purchased at 2324 Mass Avenue, which was called Fellowship House, opened. And but it's kind of interesting because of the way in which it all started, because it just sort of mushroomed after the Lord, after he became aware of the needs, and those men encouraged him, and then he left the church officially and just went full time in ministry with laymen, encouraging them in the walk of Christ. And then in 1953, it was through Senator Frank Carlson and a group of men that they started the first presidential prayer breakfast under Eisenhower's administration.
Verrede's group was officially nonpartisan, but in practice shaded toward the Republican Party, much like today's group. Until a recent reorganization of the prayer breakfast, the event was put on by the Fellowship Foundation to bring together world leaders in a Christian religious event, which in effect was a week-long lobbying opportunity. Every president since Eisenhower attended in an event which clearly made Christianity the focus. Jonathan Larson has followed the fellowship for several years and unearthed information which caused several progressive members of Congress to rethink their involvement in the event. He describes some recent changes.
The National Prayer Breakfast, historically, although under different names originally, has been held at the Washington, D.C. Hilton since 1953. And that has always been a project of the Fellowship Foundation. Even, by the way, when they wanted people to think that it was Congress doing it and they were just kind of helping out. It was always their event. And then a couple years ago, some of my reporting on the activities around the prayer breakfast, because I obtained, for the first time, I obtained extensive and in some cases, complete lists, not just of everyone who was there, but everyone who was invited even for at least 1 year. And that sort of allowed me to start putting together, well, who do they invite, right? Because no one's ever known. And everyone sort of assumes, well, it's got to be the Pope and people like that. And that's not the case. It's almost exclusively people who are friends of those associates. It's them who were doing the inviting. And so what, having all those names, the names of who was doing the inviting and who was actually being invited, sort of allowed me to piece together, oh, this is the political network we're talking about. And so they invite the people they have relations with. And that tends to be like-minded people who tend to lean conservative when it comes to their politics and to some extent to their religious beliefs as well. So what the effect of that was that they ended up boosting their allies in other countries, right? So if I'm a friend of the families in another country and I can start saying, hey, look, I've been invited by the president or Congress, even though I know that's not really who invited me, to this important national event, that boosts my profile overseas. That means that now rich people in my country who are interested in talking to American members of Congress, they now have a reason to give me donations and get on board with me. So the net effect, even if it's not the intended effect, the net effect has been to build these right-wing networks overseas, which are typically in line with the religious ideologies at work here. And so Democrats began to become aware, in part because of my reporting, of their role in helping to facilitate this network building. And they stopped going to the breakfast because of it.
What Larson describes here is what I found in my visit to the National Prayer Breakfast in 2010. While the intentions are often good, the effect is that political influence is tied to being one of the religious family. When he was alive, Doug Coe promoted nonpartisanship, but in fact, the group seemed to me to be lopsided on the side of Christian nationalist advocates. Larson, who writes at jonathanlarson.substack.com, says that tension remains to this day.
Some of them said so publicly to me. The former vice presidential candidate, Tim Kaine, Democratic senator from Virginia, he said, yeah, I'm not going to go anymore. And Chris Coons, by the way, the probably the biggest ally of the Fellowship Foundation among the Democratic Party, at least publicly, he said publicly to the Associated Press, if I remember right, that the ostensible congressional leaders of the event were unable to answer questions about who's invited, who's funding it. And so in order, I think, to rectify that, because I think people should really understand that Democratic participation is essential to the goals of the Fellowship Foundation here, because having it appear to be government endorsed or run is a big part of what they're doing. And that's what allows them access to the people they have access to. So if you lose the Democrats, now you lose the ability to say, look, this is not only nonpartisan, it's got a government endorsement. And so I would argue that to retain that fiction, it's essentially a fiction, to retain that fiction, they had to come up with some kind of change that would bring Democrats back into the fold. And their solution to that was to create a separate nonprofit entity called the National Prayer Breakfast Foundation. And as I reported, even before their first their first new event in 2023, the board of the new event was made up entirely of people with varying degrees of connection to the Fellowship Foundation and or the old breakfast. So the Fellowship Foundation itself is still doing something that's almost identical to what it used to do at the National Prayer Breakfast. They now call it the NPB Gathering, and they simulcast the president's remarks from and the various other performers and speakers from the NPB Foundation's event. The NPB, the National Prayer Breakfast, now takes place on Capitol Hill for the first time, and the fellowship is still meeting just as it did first Thursday in February. Since 1953, they still invite a few thousand of their friends from around the world, and they gather in an event that is quite obviously synced to the quote-unquote new National Prayer Breakfast.
The leaders of the fellowship and associated politicians use their influences to do Christian religious work on taxpayer expense. In essence, many fellowship-affiliated politicians were government-sponsored missionaries. Many of them used their platforms to evangelize and carry on religious activities in the name of American diplomacy. An essential resource is the Netflix documentary, The Family, based on the books by Jeff Charlotte. One thing that separates this project from the others is the organization's secrecy. Recruitment is limited to key people in positions of power, wealth, and influence. The fellowship is operated behind the scenes, whereas the other Christian nationalist ideologies have worked hard to increase popular involvement. Another thing that distinguishes the prayer breakfast movement from the charismatic movement, but aligns it with the right-wing Christian nationalists, is the manner of influence. The charismatic groups believe in a spiritual world which is in charge of the, quote, natural realm, end quote. They believe there are demons and angels fighting over Washington, D.C. for control. Almost everybody else is looking for more mundane factors, like friend-making and networking. The impact of the fellowship has been immense. Historian Kevin Cruz documents in his book, One Nation Under God, how wealthy corporate bosses in the 1930s and 1940s recruited Christian leaders such as Veridi to unite religious and nationalistic aims. This eventually culminated in the amalgamation of religion and politics, which marked the Eisenhower years. During those years, In God We Trust was added to our paper money and became the national motto. Under God was added to the Pledge of Allegiance. In light of these narratives, many Americans listened to the stories told about the founders by Christian nation storytellers, and unless they do some fact-checking or listen to this podcast, have little reason to doubt them.
Our president said last January in his inaugural address, "This is a nation under God." That was not unique to him. That has been said by many presidents. And that has been said by many members of Congress, and it was said by our founding fathers. They didn't say it's a Christian nation or a Jewish nation or a Mormon nation. They said, and our president said, it is a nation under God. And by that, we generally assume that each of the persons who say that mean that here is a nation built upon the Judeo-Christian ethic. And when you use that term, the Judeo-Christian ethic, it's important to understand what we mean by the Judeo-Christian ethic. And again, the simplistic definition would be the principles of the Old Testament, the Judeo-ethic, the principles of the New Testament, the Christian ethic. And when you look at the founding documents on the which this great nation is predicated, there can be no denial that this country was and is built upon that ethic, those principles. I'd like to address those principles today. I've made a study of what the Judeo-Christian ethic really is and why this nation has, in 206 years, become, without question, the greatest nation on earth. We're not smarter than others. We maybe sometimes think we are, but we really are not. And it's not our natural resources or the geographical location of this republic. But I believe what Solomon said 3,500 years ago. The wisest man who ever lived, Solomon said, living by God's principles promotes a nation to greatness. Violating those principles brings a nation to shame. Our founding fathers were not all saints. Nobody ever accused Thomas Jefferson of being a fundamental Baptist. And Benjamin Franklin and all the rest. But without question, again, they were men very much influenced by the Judeo-Christian principles laid down by the early Puritans and pilgrims and religious people who came here seeking religious freedom. We had all kinds of problems then, just like we have all kinds of problems now. And in spite of those problems, the principles prevailed. And a nation was carved out of the wilderness, and through great distress and times of trial, 2 centuries later, still stands as a monument to the fact that living by God's principles brings a nation to greatness.
That was founder of Liberty University and the Moral Majority, Jerry Falwell, speaking at the Cleveland City Club 42 years ago on March 26, 1982. Falwell is easier to listen to and more eloquent than Trump, but they are sounding similar notes. Both men are reaching out to predominantly white Christians to alert them that this land belongs to them and the God that they have created in their image. When Falwell said a nation was carved out of the wilderness, did he forget that there were human beings made in God's image who already lived here? Did he forget that the Puritan settlers didn't want religious freedom for Roger Williams and the other dissenters, some of whom they persecuted. Did he forget that the new nation existed in violation of God's principles by relying on race-based slavery? Catherine Stewart, author of The Power Worshippers, briefly discusses this group's history.
This is a movement that has been investing in organizational infrastructure for over five decades. This is a movement that I would say, you know, there's always been a sort of strain of some Christian nationalism in various iterations throughout our history. But the movement in its sort of current form came together in the late 1970s with a movement called the New Right, which included people like Phyllis Schlafly and Paul Weyrich and Howard Phillips and a number of other folks. They brought in what they called electronic ministers, people like Jerry Falwell and Dean James Kennedy and many others. And they really felt like at that time, the direction of America was, they felt like they were unhappy with the direction of the Republican Party itself. They felt like it had become too liberal, too soft on communism. They were unhappy with the direction of American religion and the elevation of groups like Niebuhr and Paul Tillich, these sort of more liberal theologians who were emphasizing the social gospels and the idea of a common good. And they really wanted to drag the Republican Party to the right. So they, you know, did a number of things to do that. And one of the things that they did is they formed a large number of organizations. They started working on investments in organizational infrastructure. So now the Christian nationalism is not just an anti-democratic political ideology, it's also a political movement. And its strength is in this deep and deeply networked organizational infrastructure. So you have organizations on the legal advocacy side. You have organizations on the networking side, like the Council for National Policy. You have organizations on the legislative side, legislative initiatives, like Project Blitz. You have data initiatives. You have sort of a far-right messaging sphere or propaganda sphere. Policy groups, I just want to mention, like the Family Research Council and organizations like that. And that's one of the reasons for the strength of this movement, is because if one leader falls out, think about Jerry Falwell Jr., who, you know, blew up his own career in that way. Well, there's plenty of others to take their place. The organizations are solid, even if the leadership structure shifts.
Falwell's movement was a manifestation of impatience with the approach of Arede and Co. The prayer breakfast approach wasn't focused on specific moral issues. Co simply wanted to get people in touch with Jesus without any real thought to doctrine. Falwell and his morality campaigners had more practical public policy goals in mind, and they were not content to apply a quiet diplomacy approach to achieve them. In contrast to the family, the Christian right was all about political action. In addition to the people and organizations already named, you could include Franklin Graham and Ralph Reed. In this group, right-wing politics and evangelical Christianity have become intertwined. In large measure, the activity that we're talking about here is the reason why evangelical has gone from a religious label to a political one.
Reconstruction is the broadest of those three terms. It would encompass the whole worldview of someone who believes that it's usually post-millennial worldview that believes that God, through his grace and through the influence of the Holy Spirit, is going to convert souls throughout the world, and that through their obedience, they're going to construct Christian societies. That, you know, our laws honor God, our social norms, our customs honor God, stuff like that. So the niche group that coined the phrase Christian Reconstructionism had a lot more distinct beliefs than just that, but that's what the word means in its broadest sense. We are reconstructing society to be a Christian society. And I don't think there's a single group out there that can lay the claim to we're the real Reconstructionists and nobody else is.
That was theologian and attorney Joel McDermott. Joel was once president of American Vision, a theonomist organization. McDermott is no longer in the movement and now speaks openly about Reconstructionism and theonomy.
Theonomy is a word that just means God's law. And it actually was coined by liberal theologians, existentialists, way back in the day. I want to say like 1940s or something like that. And Van Til, the Reformed apologist, used it in a very limited sense. And then it was picked up as kind of the, what would you say, kind of a badge by men like Rush Dooney, and especially Greg Bahnsen, who is a disciple of R.J. Rush Dooney. And Rush Dooney, of course, had a very specific and rigid view of applying God's law, meaning most of Old Testament law, as being the standard for reconstructing societies. And then Greg Bahnsen took that and ran with it in a very, very highly detailed way. And so that's, in fact, his book was called Theonomy and Christian Ethics and was widely regarded as the Bible of theonomy.
Last week, I critiqued Stephen Wolfe's approach as described in his book, The Case for Christian Nationalism. He falls in the Reconstructionist camp, but differentiates himself from the Christian Reconstructionist due to how he proposes to derive civil law from the Bible. In his book, he calls Christian Reconstructionists theonomists and says he agrees with them in part and disagrees in part. Quote, "Furthermore, I affirm a form of theonomy. Civil law ought to be in accordance with God's law, and civil law ought to order man to both earthly and heavenly ends. I deny, however, that the civil laws in the Mosaic law are immutable and universally applicable." End quote. Put simply, he thinks Christian nationalists should get their civil law from the Bible, but not necessarily directly or entirely from Mosaic law. McDermott is nervous about the newer crop of Reconstructionist adjacent writers.
Now, what's grown up more recently under the name Christian nationalism, and I always warned against this, I wrote strongly against this, that there was a view out there that did align themselves with our views, that was reformed, was historically conservative reformed, and that quoted our guys, that aligned themselves with our guys when it was useful, but they were not really on the same plane theologically. They were much more like classical Constantinians. When they talked about having a Christian society, they were thinking along the lines of something more like what Constantine would have done. And if they ever have the chance, they will create that type of society. And that's what I understand to be appearing in the Stephen Wolfe book. It's more of a classically based view that's mixed up with ethno-nationalist ideas and a lot of doublespeak.
Constantine was the Roman emperor who gave Christians their religious liberty via the Edict of Milan in 313 AD. This development also initiated the process of Christianity becoming dependent on the state. We examined Stephen Wolfe's The Case for Christian Nationalism in Episode 8, Wolfe and Wolfe's Clothing. If you haven't listened to that episode, check it out. McDermott wants to make sure we understand he is no longer in the Reconstructionist movement.
And I will hasten to add that for your listeners, that I don't really belong to that movement anymore. I think I grew in my expressions of how the law of God should be applied in society through the law of love in the New Testament. And it got into a lot of areas that got me in trouble, particularly in the history of racism in the United States and whatnot. And I was eventually invited to find a new career.
One major shift was no longer believing the death penalty was required for Old Testament crimes. One of the things Rush Dooney was most known for was his teaching that adulterers, incorrigible sons, and homosexuals, among others, would receive the death penalty in a reconstructed society. I will unpack this more in next week's episode on the consequences of Christian nationalism. The next group is probably the dominant group in the current scene. Most people know them by their signature teaching, the Seven Mountain Mandate. Matthew Taylor calls them the non-denominational charismatics. Most of the people in this group attend or lead churches which are not part of established Christian denominations. They believe in spiritual manifestations, such as divine healings and speaking in tongues. They talk about spiritual warfare in heavenly realms and demonic forces at work. There is an uneasy relationship between this group and the Reconstructionists that I will mention, but I want to highlight first a key methodological difference. The Reconstructionists historically conceived social reconstruction as emanating from the bottom up, and the Seven Mountains Dominionists conceive of it coming from the top down. When he was in the movement, Joel McDermott expressed concerns about the Seven Mountain people.
And then Dominionism, you know, Dominion, of course, is a very biblical word if you read the King James. And in fact, the word in and of itself really just means our home. It comes from the same root word we get our word domicile. But, you know, obviously it takes on connotations of rule and authority and government. There was a movement in the 2000s, maybe late 90s, that kind of appropriated some of that post-millennial optimism and some of that idea to reconstruct society along Christian lines that grew out of charismatic circles. I want to say YWAM was involved.
McDermott here refers to Youth with a Mission, abbreviated YWAM, and founder Lauren Cunningham. This is as good a time as any to talk about the Seven Mountains story. McDermott told me someone called it a marketing slogan.
Someone came up with this marketing slogan called, you know, there are seven areas that we have to take dominion over. And then someone said, portrayed it as Seven Mountains. And that became the marketing movement. And I use that phrase because the person who came up with it specifically told me it was a marketing ploy. And that there are seven mountains of dominion. There's the mountain of education, the mountain of politics, and I forget all the others. Family was one. And we have to take dominion. We have to sit on top of these mountains and rule them, you know. And I reacted very strongly when I heard about this.
So what did McDermott react to? Here's the story told by Lauren Cunningham.
It was in the year of 1975. It was in the month of August, and a friend had loaned us a cabin up in the Rockies of Colorado on the western slope. And we had it for a whole week. It was my first day there. We'd come in at evening time, and I was just sitting listening to the Lord. And he began to speak to me about his heart for the nations and said, I want to give you some classrooms to disciple, that is, to teach the nations. And so I had my yellow pad out. Now I have my iPad, the yellow pad. And so I started writing it, and they gave me seven of them. And I wrote them down one by one. And he said, now this is how you disciple nations. Only you do it through the people called into these various spheres, he used the term. So there's also places in society that we call the spheres of influence. Now, these spheres of influence are different than the domains of authority, though they overlap at times. Some of them overlap with authority. But I'm not talking about so much the authority. That's where we often see cults formed. So now with this, as God gave me the list, I was amazed at it. I watched it. And the difference between influence and authority is phenomenal. When leaders try to use all authority all the time, they find that people vote with their feet and leave them. But when they actually use their influence, their influence both grows, and people want to give them more authority because there's trust in it. And that's a very important thing. You watch a president or a prime minister or something, and they'll take off and start to ram things down their throats, and then they wonder why they divide the nation.
Note that Cunningham didn't initially use the term mountains. He said classrooms, and the emphasis was on teaching and influence, not dominion. Senior scholar with the Institute for Islamic Christian and Jewish Studies, Matthew Taylor, expresses well what Cunningham originally meant for his revelation to communicate.
Cunningham's imagery is still about spheres of influence. It's non-directional. It's you go into a sphere of influence and influence it. It's not like you take over the sphere of influence. You go, like, the idea is basically Christians need to be salt and light. They need to be go out. And it's a grassroots model of transformation. But then when Wallnau and Wagner get a hold of this with the mountain imagery, and then they layer in more and more dominion theology to the point where it is about spiritual warfare to conquer the tops of the mountains, because the tops of the mountains are either controlled by Satan and demons or Christians in the kingdom of God. And then Christian influence will flow down, right? So it becomes this vanguard model of capturing the top of society and transforming it almost overnight is their vision.
It was Lance Wallnau, one of the first Christian supporters of Donald Trump, who created the marketing ploy mentioned by McDermott. Wallnau took Cunningham's vision and turned it into a set of marching orders for Christian nationalism. Wallnau ridiculed the church for focusing on saving souls when it should be focusing on kings or the leaders of each of the seven spheres. This is when the top-down emphasis really gained momentum.
We've missed this point completely. My generation is so sentimental about the poor, they do it backwards. The first century had to remember the poor because they knew they had to go to kings. My generation forgets about the kings and they obsess with the poor. The kings. How does that fit? Well, you see, if you're in charge of government and you're in Argentina and the revival hasn't affected you, you ain't governing with a lot of wisdom. While Christians are in pursuit of the supernatural or the glory or prosperity, but they're missing the apostolic assignment. They're to take over spheres and administrate them for the glory of God. They're to take over spheres and administrate them for the glory of God. That's the only way you can teach nations, is when you take over a sphere and administrate it for the glory of God. So what we have is, we have a conundrum. Because you only need 8%, a minority, in the right place, and they become the leverage that shapes the culture.
Joel McDermott.
Because a lot of people were lumping our views at the time, Christian Reconstructionists, with the views of the Seven Mountains people, saying that's all the same stuff. I think it could probably be summarized by saying the Seven Mountains Dominion really looked at having a top-down approach. Where you do capture the reins of government and then impose your views on society. Whereas our view was evangelical-based, you have to convert souls before having a reconstructed society makes any sense at all. Because you can't impose stuff top-down. That is legalism, and that's something we wanted to avoid.
The foundation for cooperation between charismatics and non-charismatic leaders on political objectives was laid by some decisions made by Reconstructionist leaders during the Reagan years. Listen to religion professor Julie Ingersoll.
So in the 80s, Gary North decided that the best way to promote dominion theology was to get the charismatics to take it up, because they were the ones, despite the fact that he thought that they were heretics, they were the ones that were flourishing across the globe. And he worked really hard at this, particularly with Maranatha Ministries. And he dedicated a book to the Mumfords. And so you see this effort to put dominionism into the charismatic world in the early 1980s. And it did take hold. And then as this new apostolic reformation started to grow, that was the water it was sitting in. And it built a different kind of theology to explain what dominion means. So instead of these three spheres of authority, you have these seven mountains of influence. Their models are a little bit different. I would argue that the view that it's the job of Christians to go out into the world and exercise dominion over every living thing and all that breathes and whatever the rest of that Genesis verse is, I would argue that view, obviously, it's in the Bible, but the person who decided that this is the core of what it means to live a Christian life in our lifetimes was Rush Dooney. And I think that got handed off in some different places. And part of that was the charismatic movement, and then it got remade a bit into the Seven Mountains Dominion mandate. So it's not the same, but it's not completely separate either.
In the second episode of this series, Where is Waldo the Anointed?, Professor Ingersoll made the case that many people in the 1980s and 1990s, including Waldo himself, David Barton, were influenced by this mixed marriage of convenience between the Reconstructionists and the Charismatics. If you haven't listened to the first two episodes, this might be a good time. Although David Barton's degree is from Charismatic Oral Roberts, and from all indications his personal influences are from that world, many of the sources he used in his first books were written by Reconstructionist authors. He referred readers to Reconstructionist groups American Vision and the Providence Foundation. I don't think it's a stretch to say that David Barton owes his success to the marriage. If Peter Wagner and Rusus J. Rushtuni had a child, they might have named him David and nicknamed him Waldo. Whatever you call it, David, Waldo, Seven Mountains, MAGA, Christian nationalism, it has consequences. And that's what I want to talk about next week, the consequences of Christian nationalism.
Used to take your pills in the morning, now you're taking them at night. Writing poems in empty parking lots, hoping you don't get caught. I can't even look at that picture of you out of sight, out of mind. All I see are those stained glass tears dripping down in that chapel aisle.
Watch for a bonus episode this week on the Seven Mountains Mandate. I am winding up the series. Just two more full episodes coming up. Watch for the next one on the consequences of Christian nationalism. Telling Jefferson Lies is written, produced, and hosted by Warren Throckmorton. For more information about the podcast or the book Getting Jefferson Right, go to gettingjeffersonright.com. Today's closing song is American Dream by Kate Thornberry. Telling Jefferson Lies' theme song is The World Awaits Us All by Roman Candle. See the show notes for credits. Please like the podcast and spread the word on social media. Thanks for listening.
So loud, and a party you want is a crowd. Got a mouth.